My name's Professor Steve Hall, speaking from the northeast of England. I worked in academia for over 30 years as a researcher, mainly in criminology departments, and my perspective on economics, banking, finance, etc., comes from numerous investigations into financial fraud, into the effects of deindustrialization and the financialization of the Western economy. So I have a rather interesting angle on economics. I know quite a bit about economic history, sociology, anthropology, and neuropsychology. So I'm a bit of my friends call me a polymath. If I use that term, I'm accused of being pretentious, but that's what they call me.
Well, look, one thing doesn't make sense about what you've just said to me, and that is the financialization of the economy. Well, of course, the economy is made of money. Of course, it's going to be financialized. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that the financial economy has taken over from the old industrial economy for 200 years plus. Financial economy was the means of organizing the industrial economy, of allocating capital. Of course, it was quite a brutal system. It allocated capital where it could make its high returns. But of course, industry was producing, from the age of steam, was producing high enough returns to satisfy capital. So up until the 1970s, we had in Britain, America and Europe, the old industrial world, and of course Australia as well, parts of South America. We had industrial economies. Finance was an organizational institution. Since 1979, since neoliberals took over the Western economy, we've had a financialized economy, which means that the main source of returns are in financial markets.
Well, it's interesting you talk about 79, because this was the point at which we had the winter of discontent. It was like the unions and industry were failing. Something else had to take over, didn't it?
Well, not really. I think that the Labour Party manifesto, if you read it, 1978 was the best manifesto I've ever read. The idea was to use North Sea oil revenue to refurbish and modernise British industry, because British industry had suffered from a lack of investment from the late 1950s. I think I might have told you this story before, working in the steelworks in 1975 with a diaphragm pump on the water circulation plant, which was stamped 1948. The fitter was a genius, kept the thing going with strings, bits of string, rubber bands. Quite literally, did use string and rubber bands to keep it going. And so we suffered from a terrible lack of investment. Germany was the neoliberals' investment shock absorber in Europe, and Japan on the Pacific Rim, because they had to be rebuilt from scratch. They had been devastated during the war. And all of the money was being pumped into Germany. You could argue that the British unwisely used the Marshall Aid money to set up a welfare state, but it is a welfare state an unwise decision after all that sacrifice during the war? I don't think so. And after the terrible conditions that people endured in the 1920s and 30s in industries such as coal mining, I don't think that was an unwise decision at all. So it suffered from lack of investment. That was the problem. Stagflation, well, you have to look at that as possibly sabotage, because, of course, the banks issuing lots of cheap bank credit in the late 1960s, then the oil shock in 1973 could have been obviated by subsidising oil-intensive industries. 10% would have done it. Of course, Healey's entirely unnecessary loan from the IMF and that strange asset swap that he did with the Americans in July, I think it was June or July of 1976. I mean, what was going on there? This is skullduggery. We don't know what was going on. We could have conquered stagflation and we could have got over the hump. We could have refurbished British industry.
So what was this asset swap? What was swap for what?
Borrow dollars and pounds. Why did you borrow dollars and then just pay it back in pounds over a few months later? It was a waste of time. We didn't use any of the money. So this goes back to the old Eurodollar market, isn't it? When the capitalists in the 1950s were circumventing Keynes's capital controls, one of the first things that Roosevelt did in 1933, Attlee did in 1945, was to install capital controls. Stop. Now, not all the capital going out of the country, but a good deal of capital going out of the country. So it would be invested in our own country, in our own industry, in our own services. So they circumvented that by using Crown Territories, and Phil Bevan's a researcher that will tell you more about this, using the old Crown Territories to circulate pounds, convert them into dollars, stuff them into European banks, and use them from there. So those capital controls were circumvented straight away. So they knew how to do this sort of thing. They'd been doing it for over 20 years. The City of London, as this veteran institution, I think I've spoken about this before, 1,000-year-old, you know, it's over 1,000-year-old now, set up in 1067. And, just coming up to 1,000-year-old anyway. And they're experts at this sort of thing, at circumventing all of the regulations that governments put in front of them. And that's what they want to do. They want to disempower politics entirely. And I think when you see Rachel crying and you know, she might be facing the sack, she'll be replaced by someone else who won't be able to do anything, won't be able to challenge the money markets. And they'll just come in and out and nothing much will happen other than further privatisation and further borrowing from private money.
It's $5 billion that they were trying to shave off the budget this year, Steve. That was the idea anyway. Just this week, the Labour Party's voted this down, so they've really got to go back to square one. Does it matter? Why were they targeting disabled people? Was it even necessary?
Well, of course it's not necessary. I mean, this all, you know, depends on the myth that we need private borrowing. And the privatisers are demanding that we cut back on state spending. They don't want to cut back on military spending because the military industrial complex is putting pressure on them to, and they've just bought £2 billion worth of F-35s, haven't they? In order to defend us against an enemy that's being, you know, it's just pure conjecture at the moment. I don't think there's any chance of the Russians or the Iranians invading this country. And they want to spend it on corporate manufactured goods, military equipment. There's absolutely no need. They're targeting disabled people because it's easy. And because they're weak and they're vulnerable. And at the moment, they don't have a strong voice in Parliament. They have lots of strong voices representing them in civil society, lots of institutions and organisations who are representing them very well. But they have no real representation in Parliament. The only representatives in Parliament are looking after the interests of the big banks and big capital. So it's easy. What are they going to save? $5 billion, $6 billion? They lose $600 billion every year in tax evasion and tax avoidance. And they court the companies who are avoiding and evading tax and allowing them to set up in Ireland and various places. And it's, you know, to set up their registered offices offshore and all the rest of it. And this is quite typical of the neoliberal. They're picking on the vulnerable. And it has, I must admit, a nasty eugenics smell about it, that they simply want to leave weak and vulnerable people to their own devices, maybe to discourage them from having children and all the rest of it. And this goes back to the awful eugenics movements of the Fabians and awful people like Margaret Sanger in the early to mid-20th century. So the whole thing's unnecessary. We can afford that quite easily. It's not inflationary. In fact, luxury markets, you know, they're always complaining about millionaires leaving. Well, in fact, there are over 3 million millionaires in terms of total wealth, property wealth, and other assets. There are 3 million millionaires in this country. 0.3% of them have left the country. It doesn't matter. We don't need their money to pay for public services. And we do that through the consolidated fund at the central bank, authorised by the Treasury. We don't need tax money. We don't need their private money to pay for public services. And the luxury markets in which they operate are themselves inflationary. It's easy to work out why, because they've got lots of money. And so that means the suppliers can keep putting up the prices without losing too much custom. They just say, oh, dear me, my Aston Martin's a bit dearer this year. What a shame. And these markets are inflationary. So if they leave, it's no big deal. It's a complete nothing burger, the whole thing. We could probably do better. And they also, of course, corrupt politicians, buy politicians at the local and national levels. And we'd probably be better off without them. But they're not going anyway. So the whole thing is a complete farce. It's a scam. We don't need their money. We don't need to sell bonds. We have enough money. The state produces its own money, and we easily have money to support disabled people.
Can you just say something about the wider economy? Because we've also had figures this week, an increase in 50% roughly of people coming across the channel. We've also got the figures now in London. 80% of people in London were not born in Britain. And so there's this enormous influx of cheap foreign labour. Some of it, of course, is experts who are also cheaper to employ than British born experts. But there's this, they're always saying, well, look, actually, migration is good for the economy. It's good. But you do wonder, because obviously there is only a limited number of jobs out there. And if migrants are taking those jobs, that's going to put more people on the welfare budget. So there's a big moan about, oh, too many people are claiming welfare. But it does look as if the migrants are contributing to this, Steve. Do you think they do benefit the economy?
I think that some migrants benefit the economy greatly, yes. I think that professionally qualified and trade qualified migrants benefit the economy. They always have. We get doctors, engineers, plumbers, joiners who, at the moment, we're not producing enough of these tradesmen and professionals, so they can benefit the economy. But the problem is at the other end of the market, we have the unskilled labourers coming in. And let's face it, most of the occupants of the boats across the channel are young, working-age men. They're not families fleeing persecution and American bombs. They're young working-age men. Some of them temporarily end up in hotels, costing the state a lot of money. But like I say, it's not a problem. The state is a currency issue and can afford that. But what happens is they tend to disappear into the black economy. So that although there aren't the official jobs available, there are lots of jobs available, as we used to call in the old days, off the cards in the black economy, in the shadow economy, where they're working in a very low-paid environments and, in small factories. They're working in the service industries. They're setting up their own little businesses, which often involve some criminal elements too. We must admit that immigrants are no more criminal than we are, because we're producing a lot of criminals at the moment. There are statistical black holes of criminality, criminal markets all over the country. Don't appear on the police and British crime, the Crime Survey of England and Wales, the new one. They don't appear on the statistics created by these surveys or on the police statistics. So they're disappearing into the black economy. We don't really know what most of them end up doing, you know. You see a lot of these sort of tattoo shops and barber shops appearing on the high street. Some of them are legitimate. Some of them are involved in money laundering. We just don't know, because we don't have the money or the inclination to investigate these issues properly. So we're in a bit of a murky situation at the moment. We don't really know what's going on.
Everybody who's disabled, there's lots of urging all over the press, oh, they must go out and get jobs. But it does look as if the job market is absolutely collapsing, that it's not actually a route out of poverty anymore, Steve.
They're talking about shoeshine jobs, aren't they? They're talking about bits of part-time jobs. They're talking about volunteering. For instance, take away PIP from a person with schizophrenia, for instance. This person has social anxiety, might be going through a treatment program. It could be linked to PTSD. There could be all sorts, because a lot of the diagnoses are changing now. They're going through a treatment program. They might be just getting brave enough to face society, to get out and talk to people. And all of a sudden, they're thrust into a lousy job where they're pressured, in some sort of backstreet shop or something like that, where they're pressured. And that ruins their treatment program and it puts them back to square one. And this is because the state now thinks that the politicians and the bankers think they're doctors. They think they have you get these idiots like Tyson and his crew on social media, on television, diagnosing people and telling people that's up to doctors, that's up to professionals, therapists, doctors and family members to decide whether
But I mean, what employer wants to employ a schizophrenic person?
Well, the schizophrenic people are generally very harmless and do basic jobs. But the fact is that they don't last very long in these environments, because they suffer from social anxiety. And they should be undergoing treatment programs. And you're seeing a 25% recovery in that now. If they stick with these treatment programs and medication, a lot of people are now, more people than under the old regimes, are now actually recovering, maybe not 100%, but 90% enough to rejoin society. But ruining their treatment programs is the worst possible thing you can do. You also have people with physical disabilities, and you say, you know, I think Christ or someone like that was talking about this millionaire who has, an amputee who can sit at a desk and punch data into a computer. Well, of course he can. There's no pressure on him. He works from home. He's a millionaire anyway. And that doesn't translate into some backstreet job, shifting fruit and veg in a little warehouse in a backstreet shop or something like that. It's nonsense.
Could it be these rather unrewarding jobs that actually someone will come off benefits, go into one, find that they're not very sympathetically treated by an employer, or that it's a job that they're not really suited to, that they are not necessarily able to perform, and then they also find out that they're worse off as a result? Isn't this likely to exacerbate mental health problems? It's almost as if we're blaming society for having this ballooning benefits bill, particularly with the sickness, but could be the system that is actually responsible for it.
I think it partly is because the system puts huge pressure on people now to work efficiently. Now, efficiently doesn't mean efficient in terms of the job and producing results. It means efficient in saving money and increasing profits. And a lot of businesses are under pressure because their customer base has shrunk, especially since COVID. The services industry is in a lot of trouble. You know, pubs and restaurants and cafes closing down all over the place. They're under pressure, so that everyone's under pressure. So what you get is this revolving door of mentally or physically disabled people who don't last very long. Then they come back and they have to reapply for their benefits, and then you get someone else coming in and they don't last very long, and you get this sort of magma of floating through the shadow economy and the lower ends of the legitimate economy. And it's there's no stability, there's no security, and so a lot of, quite often, the people who suffer most are recent immigrants who are doing these awful jobs, and then other immigrants come along who offer to work cheaper and work harder, and the other ones end up losing their jobs. So you get this one ironic situation of sort of longer settled immigrants, but maybe only by a few years, complaining about recent immigrants. The whole system is a complete mess. And it appears so to old fogies like me who remember the relative stability of the industrial age and the Keynesian welfare state. And I don't care, I will argue with anyone, and I'll argue with all the facts and details that you need, that all of the social indicators of that period were far, far better than those that we have today. In terms of stability, security, mental health issues, wages, conditions, everything was far better. But we now have this myth of inefficiency in the state, not being able to run rail transport and telecommunications properly. It's all complete mythology.
Rachel Reeves is working in a very different world to, say, chancellors were in the 1960s and 70s. She was tearful. What do you make? Is it possible to look inside her head to see what's going on there? And because you do wonder whether she has been sort of buttered up a bit, to say that we think you're great at the job, and yet she's actually floundering, and she's not able to understand. There was the mainstream press is pretty terrible at this, but one thing it can do is it does notice when there's some sort of strange interpersonal stuff going on. So for example, yesterday when she's crying at PMQs over the suggestion that maybe she's just going to get the sack, she's no good, etc., with the Tory leader really laying into her. And then Keir Starmer just walks off. I mean, first of all, he won't say that she's going to remain as Chancellor, and then he just walks off without even saying a word to her. This sounds, strange interpersonal stuff that the press can't... He can't deal with the macroeconomics, Steve, but it can at least point these things out. So what's going on in Rachel's head, do you think?
Well, put my neuropsychological head on and look at Rachel, and indeed many other Labour politicians who are supporting indefensible positions, both geopolitically in places such as Gaza, and economically in terms of the slow decline of their own country as it's placed under the cosh of private money markets, private capital. I would say that there are two possibilities. A lot of people have tried to convince me that people like Rachel and Liz Kendall have dark hearts, that they're just fundamentally nasty people. Now, that's not unusual in some of the traditional so-called socialist movements, such as the Fabians, to have, you know, eugenicists. But I'm more convinced by the notion of what we call in our work fetishistic disavowal. Now, that sounds like a load of word salad, but if I explain it briefly, it's quite simple to understand. People like Rachel are put there for a purpose, which is to convince people that the country needs private capital and the state can't afford to pay for its public services, infrastructure, investment, reindustrialization, etc. It's untrue. So she has to tell a lie in order to get into a position of power. Now, some of them might think, well, they get into this position of power, then they can start resisting, but they never do. So fetishistic disavowal means that really you do know what you're doing, but you don't want to know what you're doing because that would mean losing position, your status and all the rest. So effectively, in the way you act, you don't know what you're doing. So they're going through this inner turmoil because fetishistic disavowal involves the deliberate systematic repression of what they do actually know. Now, the bankers sitting in the City of London manipulating the whole thing, they know how the system works. They know what they're doing, but they don't have to appear in public, do they? They're very furtive, secretive people. So they just push people like Rachel and George Osborne and all the rest of them, because, you know, it's a uniparty, isn't it, we're dealing with here. There's no socialist party. We haven't had a proper socialist party since Harold Wilson, I would say. And they push these people out into the public limelight in order to make their excuses for them and tell them their lies. So they're going through some sort of inner turmoil. I would have to interview each one of them individually to tell you what they're going through personally. But that's generally, I think, the situation. It's an awful position to be in. And I think that puts a huge amount of emotional stress on the individual. And you see Starmer's weird dithery sort of persona. You see Rachel crying, you see Liz Kendall blabbering and talking nonsense, and you see all of these reactions to this terrible inner turmoil of repression. They know that what they're doing is wrong.
I mean, it does sound as if someone like Rachel Reeves, there's been some sort of psychological profiling going on here, and she's ticked a few boxes, and so they put her in place.
Yeah, are we recording again here?
I'm trying to anyway, yeah.
All right, yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, like, as we were saying earlier, I think it's fetishistic disavowal, this idea that, you know, she knows what's going on. She knows the state can afford to pay for disabled people's benefits. She knows that we could buy up Thames Water. She knows that we could do lots of things. But she doesn't want to know. She's been told that she mustn't know this, so effectively she doesn't. So there's inner turmoil going on there. She has to repress knowledge that's at the forefront of her consciousness in order to operate as a politician on behalf of the city bankers and the neoliberal corporations who now control Western politics and have done for the past 46 years. So there's, should we feel sorry for her? Should we despise her? I don't know. It's difficult because that puts us in a rather, strange situation where we don't know how to feel ourselves.
I had a guest, Kevin Carhill, on, a former army officer and journalist at the Sunday Times Rich List recently, saying that he believed that there was a deliberate attempt, certainly within the special forces, to recruit a contingency of psychopaths. So this, you know, that's what he was saying, not me. And so it may be that psychological profiling in our politics, in our public life, is much bigger than we realise.
Well, yeah, I suppose it is. I know that various intelligence services from the 1950s have been very, very good at... have they been good? They've tried various techniques of mass psychology. They very rarely work efficiently, but they do watch us. They do know how we operate. I mean, I'm no way am I a fan of the French gadfly Michel Foucault, but he was right when he said that the intelligence services and the state, the captured state, does observe our behavior, and it knows how we tick, and it knows it knows how to push our buttons, and it sometimes does that very well. It likes to scare people about having to pay too much tax, and scare people over inflation, for instance. The notion, I was quoting, the rise of Nazism was caused by inflation in the 1920s. It wasn't, of course. Germans had conquered inflation by 1926, and the Nazis got 2.8% of the vote in 1928. Nazism got into power because of the devastation caused by the Wall Street crash and the retraction of capital. So it's all lies, but they know how to push our buttons, they know how to scare us, and they do it quite well. And they know, on the other hand, they know how to appease us and soothe us by not reporting terrible things that are going on. High crime, paedophilia, on islands operated by people with dodgy connections, and politicians and all the rest of the stuff. So they keep some stuff from us, but they scare us with the stuff they want to scare us with, which is always economically related. So yes, they do. I wouldn't say that they're entirely successful all the time, but they do have some impact on our lives.
So what's the role of the mass media in this?
Well, it's the mass media ranges from propaganda to sheer outright lies and distortions to distraction, in that it provides a lot of information as infotainment, as the media studies people call it, and also mindless consumer distractions that take our minds off everything, almost like a Buddhist chant in your head, simply emptying your consciousness and filling it full of consumer objects and cheap entertainment. So it functions on two levels. So that functions very, very well. In the old days, in academia, we used to have these debates about the ownership and control of the media. Now, we seem to assume that the media is in somehow democratic, in that it responds to consumer desires, the needs of the individual. But, of course, we've forgotten that the way the individual can be affected ideologically by what they view and listen to on the media every day.
There seems to be very little discussion. In fact, the BBC Question Time, which is off for the summer at the moment, the last point that was made by two of their listeners, the viewers sitting in the studio there, was we want some sort of a positive idea. We don't want you having a go at the other politicians saying we don't like what they're doing. There is no vision. And actually two individuals said the same thing. So I'm going to ask the same thing for you. What about a vision? Because the politicians are not coming up with any kind of vision, it seems to me, of the way they really want to take things that is cogent and makes sense. There's the loads and loads of this Starmer-esque toxic positivity where he's talking everything up, but it's not actually connected to reality. What is there anything that you can say to sort of show them the way, show us the way? Because it seems that it's even worse in a way when you've got politicians who are telling you everything's wonderful when you know it's going through the floor.
Well, what I would do, and this is a long process because I don't think there's much we can do in this country alone, to defy the money markets, and we've spoken about this in the past, you're talking about $160 trillion traded every day, where they can ruin your economy, and they can ruin the value of your currency, and we're import dependent, make our imports far more expensive.
Yeah, well, Keir Starmer, right, literally this week, said, I never comment on the markets.
That's right, because he dare not. They dare not talk about the markets, because the markets, we put the markets in a position where they can attack us. We've taken down our God, and we allow the markets to attack us. So what we'll have to do you remember a few months ago, Germany threatening to spend loads of public money on military refurbishment, yeah, to build up its military again because of the Ukraine issue, the scaremongering about the Russians. So they said, well, we can spend public money when we wanted to, on what we wanted to. Of course, what they wanted to is dictated by the American corporations who they're buying all this equipment from. So they know that they can spend public money up to the limit of inflation on anything they want, on refurbishing their country. So what we have to do is we have to have an international discourse with the social democratic and socialist leaders in the parties and in the institutions, the educational systems across Europe. And we have to have a mob-handed approach to this problem. We have to come to an agreement, and people must know that we can defy the money markets in an international alliance across Europe if we want to. Who's doing that now? Well, BRICS are starting to do that now. De-dollarizing. China is using its central bank, its public banks. Its domestic production is growing 6.1% a year. Its overall economy, it's still growing at 5%. They're building bridges in the sky. They're growing. The PPP, the purchasing parity, the power purchasing parity, is now better than the US. In other words, the average Chinese worker, because of the lower costs, can buy more with his or her wages than the American worker, than the average American worker, if you cut the richer Americans out of the picture. So we know we can do this. We should be talking the likes of Mélenchon in France and other socialists and social democrats across Europe to put up a serious fight against neoliberal ideology, neoliberal mythology, this idea that the state needs private money to function. It's a complete lie. In fact, all private money, whether it's through bank credit, bank loans, or through public spending and investment, comes from the treasuries and central banks of the nations. It's sovereign currency. You can't print money. It's legal. Only the state can issue money into circulation. And we should have democratic control of that, democratic control of credit and investment, and we should put that money where it's needed, into judicious reindustrialization, into utilities. We should take nationalize the water and electricity and the whole lot, and get back to some sensible economics that will work for the people of the various nations of Europe. But until we can get some sort of agreement and some sort of alliance, and we can't fight the money markets alone, Tony, I'm afraid, and that is a fact.
One thing we haven't mentioned, Steve, is housing. In a nutshell, we have been looking at this the last few weeks on the show, and it does look as if social housing is out of the window. The actual house builders are even going bankrupt, some of the smaller ones now, and the banks are taking those over. So this is the biggest outgoing we have, rent or mortgage, etc. And so is there any way to fix that housing market?
No, because again, it's operating on neoliberal principles, privatization and high rents, rent speculation. We have American economists who supposedly on the liberal left now arguing that rent controls are a bad idea, because if you control rent, the landlords won't put any money into refurbishing and maintaining their properties. So you're basically making excuses for the landlord's greed. And what they want, because their assets dripping, you've got these Blackstone and the other lot, the NED, what are they called, that big corporation in America, taking over and building rented accommodation. They're focusing more on the moneyed population, sectors of the population, such as retirees, people like me, who can afford to live in accommodation. There's one just up the road from me, just being built for expensive flats for retirees.
Yeah, and students.
And students. They're not catering for the bottom end of the market. I was talking to a friend in Nottingham, and she was saying that the people are paying almost their monthly income is going on rent. They're talking about £900,000 a week, month rent.
Well, look, I mean, the bigger picture here is that the money is meant to serve society. Actually, society seems to be now serving money.
Well, it is, and that's been, going that way since 1979. That's the whole idea of neoliberalism, is that society works to borrow money and pay it back with interest. That's the principle. And unless you're doing that, they regard you as economically inactive or economically inefficient.
Okay, so apart from getting to live in a caravan or something, which is massive, and we've got nearly 1,000 of those in Bristol now,
What about getting tooled up intellectually? Are there any good authors other than yourself, well, including yourself, that you could recommend people can read up on this stuff?
I would say that, you know, the Don is still Michael Hudson. If you want to read about financialization, I mean, read our book, The Death of the Left, first, and read about how, you know, these the politicians have been disempowered and are now experts in disempowering themselves, as we just had that discussion about Reeves and Kendall. And read Michael Hudson on the financialization of the Western economy. And how this is ruining the West. You know, it's basically I would start with The Destiny of Civilization. It's a compilation of some of the lectures that he gave on this issue. Steve Keen, very good as well, debunking economics. Some of the MMT literature is quite good, but it tends to be rather Americanized. And I would, you know, maybe keep that later, but I'd certainly read Hudson and Keen. If you want to read about the decline of the British state, David Edgerton's book, The Decline of Britain, is very good. And as I say, our book, The Death of the Left, covers all this stuff in fairly simple, bite-sized chunks. So that's a good place to start. I'm on X, used to be Twitter. Who am I? I think I'm Steve Hall on there. So follow me. And I'll keep on boring you with all this stuff until you start getting interested in it. Because we have to get interested in this. We have to educate ourselves and understand what's going on. Otherwise, all of the opposition that we put up to neoliberalism would be ineffective. We have to know how it works. Yeah.
Okay, Steve Hall, thanks very much.
Thanks very much. All the best, Tony. Bye.